We have three appeals that are scheduled for oral argument this morning. And Judge Branch and I are delighted to have Judge Rustani with us this week. Judge Rustani hails from the United States Court of International Trade. And Judge, we appreciate your coming over to help us decide these appeals this week. Thank you very much.
Quite welcome.
And the first case on the docket is the United States of America versus Anthony Johnson. Mr. Kynes is here for Johnson. Mr. Rhodes is here for the government. And Mr. Kynes, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Lee Kynes on behalf of the appellant, Anthony Johnson.
You got a tough argument to make, Mr. Kynes.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. The district court sentence was both procedurally and substantively unreasonable and therefore erroneous. I'd like to focus on one aspect of the procedural unreasonableness argument, and that is the consecutive sentences under 18 U.S.C. Section 1028A. Now, Section 1028A is the provision for aggravated identity theft, and it has a unique sentencing provision. Unlike other criminal statutes, it has a mandatory two-year sentence that's added on after the sentencing guidelines score and sentence is imposed. And the sentencing court does have discretion to run those sentences either concurrently or consecutively. But under the statute, the district court's discretion is bound by the guidelines and the policy statements underneath the guidelines. So this is not an advisory thing. This is mandatory. That is the statute. Congress has mandated that in order to exercise discretion to consider consecutive or concurrent, the district court has to consider these guidelines and policy statements.
What you think was an error, that wasn't raised till that post-sentencing hearing, right?
That's right.
And at that time, the judge said it didn't matter because he was going to do what he was going to do?
That's right. So
what do we do with that? I mean, what do we do with that?
So I think that you can apply an abuse of discretion standard as opposed to the plain error standard. And here's why I say that. So what happened was, as you accurately described, the court holds a sentencing hearing, doesn't really say why it's exercising discretion to run these sentences consecutively, except to say he's got a long criminal history, 3553A applies. That's all the court says. I'm exercising discretion to run these consecutively. Then sentence happens before judgment is entered, and I think that's important in my argument here. Before judgment,
the court did expressly acknowledge these factors.
The court. So I think here's the point: the court never mentioned 5G 5G1. Let me make sure I get this right. 5G 1.2 application note 2 never specifically mentioned that section, and importantly, never mentioned.
Is the court required to mention it?
At a minimum, I think that makes the most sense, and I think it would be helpful for this court to give the district court's guidance on that. At a minimum, where the factor is relevant, the district court should acknowledge the factor. So, for example, in this case, groupability is really the issue here because the other two factors, the nature and seriousness of the offenses and 3553A, those are almost always going to be discussed by the trial court. But groupability is an important issue here, and this is subsection 2. This is the second factor under 5G 1.2 application note 2. That section says generally multiple counts of 18 U.S.C. 1028 should run concurrently when the underlying offenses are groupable. Now the court still has discretion, even if they are groupable, to run them consecutively. But it specifically says that generally, if they're groupable, then the count should run concurrently. So because of that, because groupability is relevant in this case, the underlying offenses were groupable. That's what the PSR says. and that's what the law says. Because the groupability was relevant in this case, that's the district court should have acknowledged that. And that's what happened in this post-sentencing hearing. The court recognizes its error on an enhancement on a different issue, and it says, I'm going to make the same sentence anyway. And at that point, Mr. Johnson, who's representing himself, makes the point about groupability. He says, Your Honor, these cases, the underlying offenses are groupable. I think they should be concurrent. And the district court says essentially what Judge Rustani said, which is that it doesn't matter. I have discretion to impose these sentences concurrently or consecutively, and I've chosen consecutively.
Can I ask you a question about something you said? You said it made a difference whether it was before judgment on the standard. At the time of that post-hearing, that they had the post-sentence hearing, it was beyond the time when the judge could amend the sentence anyway. So I'm not sure what difference before judgment in a situation where he couldn't change the sentence.
I understand that point, and I read that in the transcript, and I'm not frankly sure what to do with that. I think the point is here that Mr. Johnson did make the argument, and the court reflected its in the post-sentencing hearing, the court reflected its reasoning in the pre-sentencing hearing. So I think that that the abuse of discretion standard should apply, but even if the plain error standard applies, it was still error because it was error. Because substantial rights were affected, and because the error is plain, that is, the statute requires this. The statute requires that these factors be considered.
Let me ask you a question about the obstruction, although I understand it doesn't affect the calculation of a sentence as much.
Right.
I take it the argument is that he didn't really make a finding of willfulness, and is the argument that because there was something that said that this man had some issues that needed to be addressed regarding his mental status, is that why the finding of these actions were, and a lack of a finding of willfulness was significant, or is it something else?
Well, I think the reason it's significant is because there's a fine line, I think, between a frivolous argument or a fanciful argument and willful obstructive behavior, especially when you're talking about the right to make defenses, right? We don't want to chill a defendant's right to make defenses, even if they're frivolous or fanciful. That doesn't cross the line. There's a line between frivolous and fanciful and obstructive. That's my point. And I think to be obstructive, there has to be a finding of willfulness, a specific finding of willfulness.
How does the mental state play into this, if at all?
I don't know that it does. I don't recall seeing that anywhere. I mean, I know that the court considered his mental state before allowing him to proceed pro se, and before allowing him to be sentenced,
did come up with groupability.
He did come up with groupability. He certainly had some time to think about it and came up with that. He's certainly focused on his case and understands his case.
But you, when you were talking about the concurrent versus consecutive,
yes,
and that the trial court didn't consider the factors, and you said, well, the court certainly looked at the criminal history, but
right,
in looking at the criminal history, isn't it at least arguable that the district court has satisfied these factors?
I'd say no. I'd say it's arguable that they looked at the first and third factor, but not the second at all. The groupability issue. And I want to call the court's attention to a case that came out about 3 weeks ago from the Sixth Circuit. It's called United States versus Potts, and there's no federal reporter yet. I have the Lexis site, if that's helpful. It's 2020 U.S. app, Lexis 576. And that case has sort of a broad survey of the circuit's approaches to this issue, the issue we're talking about, the 1028A and what's required of the district courts. And it describes sort of a range of approaches from the more flexible to the more rigid. And there is a range of approaches among the circuits. But the bottom line is that that case comes to is the point I made earlier, which is where a factor is relevant, as it is here, the court has to consider it, and there has to be a discussion on the record of that factor. So the conclusion they come to in the Potts case, in that case, groupability didn't matter. So the fact that the trial court never mentioned groupability wasn't a factor. They didn't have to mention groupability. But there are other cases, the Dooley case, which we cited in our brief, and that's we sort of relied on. That took a less flexible approach, according to Potts, but nonetheless said that the court didn't discuss anything about the 501G factors. And I believe that groupability would have been a factor in the Dooley case. Another case that I'll point to is this case from the Second Circuit, and these are all cited in that Potts case. It's called Chibuco, and that's at 744 F3rd 259. And that's the case that comes up with this sort of a flexible approach, which is this relevancy point. And this is what they say. A court cannot ignore the factors that Congress has instructed it to consider. Thus, the amount of explanation required by a district court for its sentencing decision will vary with the circumstances. If the facts in the party's argument suggest that a guidelines factor, such as groupability, is relevant, there should be some indication in the record that the court considered it. And that is considered one of the more flexible, mid-level approach in the range of flexibility to rigidity. I do want to mention this court's Bonilla decision, because Potts mentions it. And I don't think that the Bonilla decision, which is cited in the government's brief, not cited in our briefs, I don't think that that case really says anything about what the district courts are supposed to do. But the Bonilla case, all that case says is that the district court did consider the 501G factors without more. I think the Potts case, which is the Sixth Circuit, describes the Bonilla case as a flexible approach, but I don't think the Bonilla case actually offered an approach at all. So I think, and I mentioned this in the brief, there are a couple of unreported decisions in this circuit, but I don't think this court has directly addressed the approach that the district court should take in this circumstance.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Kynes. We'll hear from Mr. Rhodes on behalf of the government.
Thank you. May it please the court. David Rhodes for the United States. I'll first start by addressing the consecutive sentences on the aggravated identity theft offenses. The important thing to remember here is, one of the important things to remember is, we're under plain error review on that. The defendant is complaining that the court didn't identify the 5G 1.2 factors that it considered in deciding to impose consecutive sentences. But that was never brought up at sentencing, nor was groupability brought up. And we can't tell from this record, there's certainly nothing suggesting that the district court erred in what it considered in making that determination. One, it does not have to impose concurrent sentences, even if the offenses are groupable. That's just one of the criteria for the court to take into consideration. And the court made clear throughout this entire sentencing, which went on for hours, including a 40-plus minute break for the court to decide what it wanted to do here, that the most important factors here are the 3553A2 factors, which is explicitly to be considered in deciding whether to impose consecutive versus concurrent sentences. The primary issues were to provide just punishment, protect the public from future crimes of the defendant, and the nature and circumstances of the defendant's history. That's what the court was focusing on in making that decision. So even though the defendant brought up at the subsequent hearing that sort of odd little status conference that happened after sentencing the groupability issue, one, as Judge Rustani pointed out, at that point the judge couldn't change its sentence. It had already pronounced sentence at the earlier proceeding. And two, the court explained then, I understand that these are groupable, I decided to impose consecutive sentences. So, and if you look back at what happened at sentencing, the court knew these were groupable. It said that in the pre-sentence report. The court announced that the offenses, the underlying offenses, were groupable. The pre-sentence report pointed the court to the applicable guidelines, which 5G1.2, of course, identifies the three criteria that the court is going to take into account. So the court knew these were groupable, decided anyway that it would impose consecutive sentences for those offenses. That was
say why it decided to do that?
Well, it said two things. That through the entire hearing, the court explained why the defendant's history was significant and why that took precedence over the sentencing guidelines, which, of course, the sentencing guidelines range doesn't apply to the 1028A sentences. And then said, when he announced that he was going to impose them consecutively, he added, his record of identity theft is decades long, which goes directly to the 3553A2 factors. It says, each time he did it advisedly with a record of having done it before, which again points out the incorrigibility, which was a word the court used to describe the defendant. And then he said, it's appropriate under 3553A to sentence him for each of those on a consecutive basis. So that was sort of the culmination of the court's explanation for why it was doing that.
Is this a misprint? He really has 100 prior convictions?
He had 99 prior convictions, felony convictions, all versions of fraud-related things before this case came along. Six prior prosecutions, five of them federal. And each one started as soon as he got out of prison. One started while he was still in prison. And that was the driving force. If there's anything that's obvious, either from the circumstances of this case or the district court's explanation of why it was doing what it was doing, I mean, he'd been at this so long that 82 of his prior felony convictions weren't even on the scoreboard when his pre-sentence report was being calculated. And it'd been so long that he'd gone from a Category 6 at his last prosecution in the Middle District of Florida to a Category 5. So he was upending the system for calculating someone's offense level here. So anyway, going back to the consecutive sentences, the court was not, there's no law requiring the court to say, I've considered the 5G1.2 sentences. We've cited a few unpublished cases from this court where they say that. Bradshaw is one of them. And that sort of points out the problem when we're under plain error review here, because if the defendant was representing himself, but that was his choice. If he had pointed out what he did at the subsequent thing, well, what about the fact that these are groupable? Well, we know because we had that subsequent hearing what the court would have done. He would have said, I understand that they're groupable. You still deserve consecutive sentences. So that would have resolved it. And that's why we're under plain error review.
And at the sentencing hearing, as you noted, the court says we have a grouping issue because of the nature of the crime. So the court, it has it on the record.
The court was well aware. I mean, it didn't discuss that specifically when it was addressing the aggravated identity theft offenses. That's the only thing, if anything's missing here, that's the only thing that is missing. But that's the thing that we, number one, the court doesn't have to. There's no law that says the court has to announce that it is doing that. And there's nothing from this record that tells us that the court didn't consider those factors.
Can you straighten me out here a second? He talked about groupability on the fraud side. And then did he talk about groupability at any time before the post-sentencing hearing in relationship to the
The aggravated identity theft offenses? No, he did not, Your Honor.
So the groupability before the sentence was imposed was about the fraud cases?
Correct.
Okay.
But that's the significance. I mean, those were the offenses that were grouped, and the fact that those are grouped is something for the court to take into account in deciding whether to impose consecutive sentences. But he never said anything at the original sentencing that tied those together. That's correct.
Do I understand that the sentence is about twice as much as what the government was seeking?
We sought It's not exactly. We sought 20 years for the guidelines or for the underlying. Well, really, I take that back. We sought a 20-year sentence plus 6 years for his violation of supervised release. So even though that's a separate thing, a total period of incarceration of 26 years. That's what we sought.
You sought a total sentence of 240 months.
Correct.
Okay.
For these offenses. That's exactly right.
And the guideline maximum was what?
For the guidelines range, it was 71 months. Well, it depends on how you look at it. I'm treating it as the lower sentencing range, taking into account what the court pointed out was its error at the original sentencing. When he was originally sentenced, it was 70 to 87 months. But after the court recognized that error, which we acknowledge and we accept that here, then you're down to the top end of the guidelines range was 71 months. So the court varied up from 71 to 240 months on those fraud counts.
That's pretty high over. The government asked for 240 months and then he gets an additional 18 years. That's pretty high.
There's no question this is a very substantial upward variance mm-hmm. on the fraud counts. And there's no question that the total, when you factor in the other the consecutive sentences for the aggravated identity thefts, but you have to look at you don't have to, but what you should look at is everything the court said about its reasons for doing so. It did not consider an impermissible factor. It weighed the different 3553A factors in deciding what was an appropriate sentence. And basically what the court said was that this guideline range doesn't inform what we need to do here. It's woefully, excuse me?
No, I don't, keep going.
It's woefully inadequate, and it's woefully inadequate because, for some of the reasons I just said, it literally doesn't take in a lot of the defendant's body of work, but it also doesn't take into account what the court decided were the most important 3550.
It's a very long sentence, and technology is going to change. It seems to me that perhaps there should have been some consideration of, in 44 years, are we even going to be talking about the same kind of identity crime? I mean, isn't the idea that don't make a sentence that's longer than necessary? I mean, isn't the sentence longer than necessary when you think about what kind of crime this is and how technology changes?
Well, I would say this, that the sentence isn't supposed to be longer than necessary, but the flip side of that, it has to be sufficient to serve the purposes of sentencing. So it's not really just a one-way ratchet. But beyond that, I mean, I feel like it would be speculation as to what this defendant would be able to do if and when he is released from prison based on changes in technology. But we do know, based on this defendant's mindset, and this is what the district court found, that as soon as he is out, he is going to be at this again. And we have a history that establishes that. So that's what the court was focusing on there. And the court did not abuse its discretion, notwithstanding the length of the sentence, given the court's prerogative to decide which of the 3553A factors within reason, obviously, are the most important ones here. So when you talk about, I mean, I know we have to look at the guidelines range, but if you look at what the Supreme Court said in Kimbrough, they said the district court can wholesale, by disagreeing on policy grounds, ignore a guidelines range. That, of course, was the crack cocaine guidelines, and the sentence was going in the opposite direction. The court did it there. But the other thing the court said was if a court is deciding in a particular case that the guidelines shouldn't control it for whatever reason, it's outside the mind run of cases, that's where the district court's discretion is even greater, and that's where the deference to the district court should be even greater. And that's what we have here.
We've said before, though, that one of the factors that we take into consideration in determining whether or not a sentence is substantively unreasonable when it goes above the guidelines is the extent of the departure. And 18 additional years on top of what the government asked for, that's a long time.
There's no question that's a long time, and there's no question that's a valid consideration. But let me just make one final point about that. When we're, and I don't know how this plays out, but the variance that the court imposed was to the 240 months. And so I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to consider the amount of the variance from the guidelines range by taking into account what the court did with the aggravated identity theft sentences, because for one reason, that guideline range doesn't relate to those. That relates only to the fraud and Social Security number counts. But beyond that, when the court is imposing a sentence for aggravated identity theft, that statute, it really does have one truly unique provision, and that is that the court, in imposing sentences for the underlying offenses, cannot take into account what it's going to do with the aggravated identity theft sentences. So the court was obligated to look at the fraud by itself without considering the 1028. And I know it's odd, but that's the way Congress has established this. So the court, as he said at that status conference, I varied up to 240 months. That's the percentage variance from the guidelines range. I'm not saying, obviously, that the decision to impose consecutive sentence isn't subject to review by this court. It definitely is. But that, I don't think it's really fair to look at this as a variance of that percentage all the way up to the 456 months that the court imposed.
Well, it seems to me that might cut towards viewing this as a plain error matter, because if it's so separate, then it's imperative to consider groupability.
Well, the court's obligated. I agree the court is obligated to consider groupability, those factors in 5G 1.2. What I don't agree with is that, one, it's plain that the court didn't consider that, because there's nothing in the record indicating that the court didn't consider that. And I don't agree that it's error at all for the court not to have said that, it specifically said that, I've considered the three criteria in 5G 1.2. So that's where we diverge, or one of the many places where we diverge. But I think given that standard of review and given the thoughtfulness that the court placed throughout this entire sentencing process, we ask that the court affirm the conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes. We'll hear again from Mr. Kynes.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I wanted to start with the disparity between the guidelines range and the sentence. And Mr. Rhodes is correct that there was an upward variance from 71 months to 240 months on the underlying fraud counts. That's still more than triple the guidelines range. And then on top of that, there's 18 more years for the consecutive 1028A sentences. I would suggest that is far beyond necessary. Also, for the sake of uniformity and predictability, a sentence this far outside the guidelines range, even if you just talk about 240 months, it's so far outside the bounds of the guidelines range that it would be impossible to know whether it's uniform or not. And I'll make that sort of dovetails into the unnecessary sentencing disparities. I mean, the uniformity point, the reason for the sentencing guidelines is in part to make sure that similarly situated criminal defendants are treated fairly. With a sentence like this, it's impossible for that to happen. Let me just touch briefly once more on the Section 1028 sentence. The government has acknowledged that the court is obligated to consider all of the 5G 1.2 factors, and the statute requires that, of course. And the record in this case is clear, I believe, that the court didn't consider the groupability factor. The district court has to make a record sufficient for this court to review whether it actually followed the law or not. And it didn't do that in this case. So for that reason, I would ask the court to reverse the sentence and remand for resentencing, in particular on that 1028A factor on the 1028A factors, but also for the remainder of the errors that we identified in our briefs.
Thank you, Mr. Kynes. And you were appointed by the court to represent Mr. Johnson, and the court thanks you for your service.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Mr. Rhodes.